This week, we are talking about how decisions are made about changing Bitcoin and the ongoing evolution of the Bitcoin software with one of my favorite thinkers in the space, Tomer Strohlite. I hope you enjoy. All right, welcome to another episode of the Block Reward Podcast. This week, we are thrilled to have a return guest. It's been a while. Tomer Strohlite, welcome back to the show, man.
Hey, nice to be back.
Yeah, I think it's been about a year and a half, and I was pumped to have you on for the first time. We were together in Montreal at the Canadian Bitcoin Conference this past week.
Yeah, it feels like I just saw you. What are you talking about, a year and a half? I feel like I just saw you last week.
So I guess a lot's changed for you since you were last on the show. Maybe we could just start with, like, you know, what have you been musing on lately with Bitcoin?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. There's two things that are really taking up my productive time as it relates to Bitcoin. One is, broadly speaking, education. I think there's a couple of education initiatives that I'm involved in that would formalize some teaching to different groups of people, students and military personnel potentially. And then there is general education I'm providing, which is focusing on helping people understand Bitcoin as it is rather than through metaphor. Because I think there's a lot of metaphor that people use to describe Bitcoin. Some metaphors are actually really bad, but many are good, but have limits. You know, and if you don't know how the thing actually works, you don't know where the limit of the metaphor is. And people keep trying to come up with better metaphors, but I'm thinking, why not just teach people how what Bitcoin really is made out of and how it really works? And then you don't have to reason through metaphors like, you know, it's energy and it's a dart with an arrow, or, you know, it's a dartboard with an arrow. And it's like, it's all these sorts of things. If you can understand some fundamentals, and you don't need to understand all the complicated math that goes into Bitcoin, but if you can understand that numbers are less than or greater than other numbers, and you can understand that everything in the digital realm is represented by numbers, and you can let me explain to you what this one function called SHA-256 does and how that can get used, then I can explain to you all the different things that are starting to happen in Bitcoin. And you can reason about it. You can understand it as it is, and you can reason about it for yourself without having to rely on experts who tell you that they're experts and that you're incapable of reasoning about it. So the whole field of teaching people what Bitcoin is, kind of at a technical level, not at the how to read code and how to write code, but what's actually going on physically or, you know, code-wise in Bitcoin in a way that's accessible to everybody. That's a big part. And then thinking about Bitcoin's long term and what's been happening. I don't want to get tired out in the current debate between knots and core that's very active. But I think what it points to, that maybe a bit of an original conversation to have, is starting to think about, okay, well, the governance of Bitcoin is breaking down or breaking up, you know. Like, you know, breaking down means it's not working. Breaking up means we're going in two different directions. And this is the governance of Bitcoin software development. And I think maybe this is because we've seen Bitcoin's development follow a particular path for a particular time. And it hasn't led to ideal outcomes, but there are people who are still really committed to it. We need to do like some decent postmortems and have some decent conversations around what's been done and what's been successful about it and what's not been successful about it. We may still disagree about a whole bunch of things. But, you know, back to the technical or the education conversation, I think different people are coming to Bitcoin for different specific needs. And we're getting, and the reason for this digression, this breakup, this breakdown, whatever you want to call it, seems to me at least to be partly due to different objectives and different priorities developing in different camps of Bitcoin. And everyone just assumes that they're view of the destination of Bitcoin is widely shared or is the right view. And we clearly aren't all in alignment on that. And so having some discussion about that and maybe refocusing some efforts or creating new efforts to focus rather than just fighting head to head, if we had something to fight for rather than something to fight against, that would make it not so much a fight, but we'd have something to work for rather than someone to fight against. And I think that's maybe where we're caught up right now. And you know, I don't know for sure that the peaceful exit is by finding something we all want to work on rather than finding someone we want to fight against. Oh, there's a start for you.
Yeah. I mean, it's a big question. I you know, how Michael put it in the episode we recently did with him was sort of to say there's a fundamental disagreement around whether those working on CORE are like custodians of the project or innovators. You know, what is the principal responsibility of,
Right. And what is it that they're custodians of, even if they're custodians, right? Like what is it? So I think that this has really become a big part of the challenge that we have, because when we have a group of people who want to do something and a group of people who don't want to do it, where we do get stuck in this fight around what ought we be doing. And there's probably a lot of really good stuff to do that's outside the scope of how, you know, the term bike shedding, I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's like when a committee has a big argument over what color to paint the bike shed when they're building a whole museum or something, right? It's called bike shedding because it's irrelevant. And we're having this moment of having an intense fight over how big one variable should be and whether who should change it and why they're changing it and all this kind of stuff. And it speaks to committee think, right? It's like, we don't know what we can do. Like, is this the biggest idea that the innovators / custodians, whichever role they have, this is the biggest idea they actually have? I'm relieved in one sense if this is the biggest idea that they have, because I'm a conservative. And it's like, okay, well, you know, they're going to change one variable. They don't have such big ideas, but there are ideas on the horizon for adding lots of opcodes, old opcodes that were once deprecated and new opcodes that might permit all sorts of functionality. And I'm anxious, like not eager, but nervous about what the implications of those might be. And I know that there will be a huge debate if those things are going on. But there's so many things that we could probably all agree would be useful priorities. And maybe if we can't all agree, at least some of us would agree and work on those priorities, just making Bitcoin CORE easier to use, faster to do the initial block download, more specified in what you want to or need to prune if you're choosing to prune. There's probably a lot of room for improvement just in usability and user interface. So focusing on things that support the monetary use case could be a good vein to go in, but I feel like we've elevated CORE to having to be these great scientists who come up with the next great thing after walking in Satoshi's footsteps, and it's got to be SegWit or Taproot or Covenants, or, you know, and it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be that. I think we can, I'm not going to say we can all agree, but I think for many of us, Bitcoin is money, and everything we can do to make that monetary use case, the usability even better, faster, easier, is desirable without compromising the monetary use case. And that I think is where the big debate is coming down right now. It's like, if we're doing anything other than the monetary use case, it's diluting the monetary use case. Say so. Others say, you know, we're just trying to do the non-monetary stuff as harmlessly as possible and to allow for innovation. And when we have a breakdown of trust around those claims, those ambitions, all those sorts of things.
You know, not to have metaphors, I don't actually think this is a metaphor, but how I have been thinking about it is like, imagine some sort of dystopian future where a small group of people has the only viable seeds left, you know, like an ark. And those people, you know, would we want them monkeying around with the seeds that we do have, or would we just want them being kept safe?
Well, that's definitely a metaphor.
It's of that magnitude. You know, it feels like it's of that magnitude.
That's why it's like, you know, there are people who really hold dear that Bitcoin is our only chance at escaping dystopia, right? In a broad sense, there's specific reasons why they argue that. And so they're very wedded to the specific features of Bitcoin that lead to the escape from dystopia, the prevention of compromises that would compromise Bitcoin to the point where it could be a tool of creating dystopia rather than a tool of escaping it, or any efforts that diminish its capacity to escape this. So there are people who hold it in very high regard and very high esteem, very important. and are loath to make any modifications. And then you've got, and I don't think this is, I'm drawing it as a spectrum with my hands here, but I think you've got people all over the place where there are people who think that doing that, that achieving that escape from dystopia requires making particular modifications to Bitcoin that have been very hard to make, and they've been advocating for them for years, and they haven't been listened to, and they haven't been successful in making those changes. So there's emotional frustration in there, and they have a contempt now for the people who they see as having prevented them from making these changes. So both sides may see themselves not just as good guys, but as fighting the exact same fight, the escape from dystopia, the escape from tyranny, but they see different means and incompatible means to getting there. And having that conversation in a way that's constructive hasn't really worked so far.
I mean, it seems to me that it's at least possible that if you knew that you couldn't destroy Bitcoin or take it down, then co-opting it or changing it in some, like the next best thing you might be able to do
is the method of destroying it. You know? Yeah, I think this is where it's healthy to be paranoid and not naive, but it's also dangerous to be too paranoid, because your paranoia can cause you to be afraid of ghosts that aren't really there, you know. And so getting to stepping away from paranoia and versus naivete and stepping into neutral, objective analysis and assessment, but thorough assessment and open-minded assessment is where we need to go. But if you actually are in a camp that says, you know, for sure that one thing is good or that one thing is awful, before having given a fair hearing to both sides, then you're not really contributing to the dialogue. You're merely taking an arbitrary position and arguing, you know, for it with whatever arguments you can come up with, ignoring the arguments against it or trying to come up with contrary arguments. You're in like an adversarial system, like our courts, like the law, where somebody's accused and then he has a defense attorney and a prosecuting attorney, and, you know, or someone suing somebody else. And it's set up as an adversarial system with one winner rather than as a system that's trying to find the ideal truth. And that's the role of a judge in our courts, to say, well, what's the truth and how do I have to decide if I have to decide one way or the other? And of course, judges do actually have a spectrum, right? They can find somebody guilty of a lesser offense. They can impose a harsher or weaker sentence. So they have room to move, but it's the onus is on them to listen to all the facts and come up with a solution. I think we all need to not be just advocates for a particular side because we're paid to. I mean, that's what lawyers do, or because the law is on our side. What our fair judgment comes down to, given what we're pursuing. Now, when we're all pursuing, if we're pursuing different goals, we're going to have different judgments of the same situation. And that's something we have to live with in Bitcoin, because we're never going to actually have consensus around everything that Bitcoin should do and shouldn't do to the last final detail. So we have to be prepared to accept that there's going to be disagreement, and that therefore we have to be aware that Bitcoin, there's no judge of Bitcoin that says, I'm declaring this or that not. That's the consensus rules. That's the judge in Bitcoin, right? And the consensus rules don't come and judge you after the fact. They judge you before the fact. If you're trying to do something that violates the consensus rules, they judge it outside the consensus rules, and they reject it and prevent you from committing the offense. So it's not like someone double spent and now we have to reverse the transactions. Like, nobody was able to double spend. Nobody was able to issue more coins than are allowed by the issuance policy. So Bitcoin's different, right? It has laws. Those are the rules. We've got both consensus and policy rules, which are kind of like inviolable rules versus gentlemen's agreement rules. It's got the executive of executing the rules, right? Which is the nodes that execute the rules. And it's got the judges, which are the consensus rules. Did I say judges already? It's got lawmakers, right? And lawmakers are the coders. They try to write rules. It's hard for them to pass the laws, right? Because unlike a democracy where the lawmakers are also the law passers, right? They write the laws and then they have an election in Congress, you know, they vote on it in Congress and the executive approves it. It's like, well, in a sense, anyone can write rules in Bitcoin and anyone can release them. But to get them executed requires the node runners to run the, to upgrade or download whatever the font, you know, the term upgrade has been bastardized now. So, but it requires people to run the rules to, in order to enforce and obey the rules. And if not everybody runs new rules, then those new rules aren't enforced. And I think this is where we're seeing all kinds of debates now in Bitcoin governance, for lack of any better word, is probably the best word we have. We have the core consensus code and the historical policies that are widespread that ensure that certain rules are absolutely followed and ensure that other rules are generally followed with some, you know, sometimes exceptions, but not always exceptions. And then we have people trying to modify some of those policy rules because they're not immalleable and 100% certain. And we have people who are objecting to it. And I actually think that the right way to have framed this debate from the outset, and of course, hindsight is 2020, should have been, do you know what? Policy used to be very reliable. That's not consensus, but it was very reliable. It was a gentleman's agreement that everybody ran these, just about everybody ran these rules, and that miners ran these filters too. So very little got through. Individuals could go to miners and they could, you know, do special non-standard transactions, but it, these were generally few and far between. And then we had the issue of inscriptions. And inscriptions were actually standard transactions. They were, I'm going to use the word exploit. I know there's people who disagree with it, but they were an exploit that it permitted people to put digital files that weren't just financial transactions into transactions and strictly obeying all the rules of standardness. So not even violating policy. And people got upset about that, right? It's like this non-monetary use case of Bitcoin. And it squeezed in, not by the original consensus rules, but based off of the soft fork changes that we had made in SegWit and Taproot. And now they're there. And so people are exploiting them. And there were people who wanted actions taken, but no action was taken. So there was a governance issue that was dealt with by ignoring it, which may have been the right thing to do or may not have been the right thing to do. Like I think the mature view said, these people, this is a stupid use case of Bitcoin. The people who are doing it and spending lots of money doing it are going to run out of money. It's expensive to use Bitcoin while those people are doing the stupid, irrational things, but their lesson will be learned. And indeed, that was largely true. There's still a fair amount of block space that's used by inscriptions, but the fees, you know, at when they first came out, fees were 1,000 sats per V-byte. Now we're lowering fees to below 1 sat per V-byte because everybody knows these things just aren't worth doing. There's also less usage of the blockchain for monetary use cases, which we can speculate on why that is too. But we ended up with this issue, and then a few things happened, and like Marathon Mining launched Slipstream, which allowed for non-standard transactions to be submitted through a portal. It became formalized that there was a way to submit non-standard transactions. Peter Todd launched Libre Relay, which was a node that softened policy requirements and relayed around, often directly to miners, non-standard transactions. And again, the reaction that we had was, well, we're not going to try to fight it. We're going to accept that it's a reality of the network. And these non-standard transactions amount to a lot of non-monetary transactions. So you've got two sides again, one saying, well, you know, it's very hard to change and enforce policy when you've got people actively violating policy. So we might as well accept that reality. And you've got people saying, Bitcoin is money. Stop accepting the reality that people are doing non-monetary things with it. It's bad for Bitcoin. And some of these discussions have really gone into the ditch in the sense of like, it's very hard to have a conversation when one side of the debate just presumes that the other side is an idiot or that the other side is evil. But we've got a lot of that going from both sides. So that conversation has essentially ended and everybody's picked up their ball and gone home. Core has said, we're launching these features. We're by and large preventing people from commenting against the features on any of the repos, the commenting repos we control. And they've said, okay, well, we're going to run a different client that doesn't do the things that Core does on policy front. And we'll see where it ends up. But we've really lost the constructive dialogue of saying, okay, what's good for users in Bitcoin, and what do we want to do? We're focused on these edge cases of people who aren't using it for money in one hand and people who don't want that on the other hand. And so we're not really improving Bitcoin. We're fighting over what constitutes a degradation of Bitcoin and how best to fight it. It may be the most important conversation. I don't want to say that it isn't, but it's sure far from the community of people focused, having the great money and focused on making it better, right? We're a community of people who are debating whether it is great money that we have and whether or not we should make its monetary use case better rather than its non-monetary use case better. And I think that is what's really, even on a subconscious level, getting to the heart of people, why people are so emotional about this, in particular from the monetary maximalists, as they're now called, both by themselves and their critics.
Yeah, those people just used to be called Bitcoiners, but okay.
Yeah. You know, Bitcoin used to be a purely monetary phenomenon. And then when this other stuff happened, I can actually understand the other side of this argument. It's not that I have no sympathy to it, but at the end of the day, you have to come down one way or the other. And where I'm coming down is Bitcoin does have a purpose, and its purpose is money. And its purpose is money for the very long term. And in that case, we got to make sure that it does a very good job of being money for the very long term. One of the things that says is we shouldn't do stuff quickly. Like, this is besides this debate and this decision. It's like, we should really, really take our time, because the history of money shows that if you make abrupt changes to it, you debase it, you damage it. And it has long-term unforeseeable consequences. You know, people talk a lot about game theory. And the one thing that you learn if you watch game theory analysis is very few people, even people who call themselves experts in game theory, are able to use it to make accurate predictions of scenarios, right? And that, there's a saying by some famous general who says, no plan in war survives after the first bullet is fired, right? And it's like, chaos ensues, the fog of war. People do unpredictable things specifically because they know that you've reasoned out the rational things that you would do. So you have to do something irrational to mess up their plans, and all sorts of things happen. So like, game theory is very practical when you say, look, all roads lead to the same outcome, or all roads lead to one of two outcomes. So we need to prepare for one of two outcomes, even though there's a million different paths that people can take. But when you presume that everyone's going to take one path because of game theory, you're mistaken, right? Even in the simple game of Prisoner's Dilemma, I've participated in studies where the game is played repeatedly. And when you play the game repeatedly, you get very different outcomes than when you play the game only once, especially if people know you play the game repeatedly. So, and it's not necessarily that the same outcome happens every single time in a repeat version. It's like, people start to experiment with playing it differently, and then they see the outcome, and then they ultimately settle on something, or they don't. And you can have one wild card in the group that really messes up. Like, you don't always get the same results when you put different people into the game. So this was, what was I getting at now? I've lost my own train of thought because I've talked about game theory and the battle. It's to move slowly, right? And to think adversarially, and to realize that the moves you make, this is like chess. There's no take backs in Bitcoin. It's like competition chess. And once you make a change to the code, you can't unmake it. Like, if you do a soft fork, to undo a soft fork is a hard fork. And you can't practically do a hard fork and not leave behind a huge chunk of the network. There's lots of nuances again, and I don't want to get into too many technicals of different kinds of things because we're not even discussing any particular proposals. But we have to move very carefully. And I think part of what we learned is the changes that we made to Bitcoin over the years allowed for the inscriptions exploit to take place. And many people didn't expect it. It certainly wasn't an advertised feature of either SegWit or Taproot or the two combined. And, you know, and it took several years, but it ended up becoming the main application of Taproot. More like, the overwhelming majority of Taproot transactions are inscriptions. They're not, you know, Merkleized abstract syntax trees that are allowing for different spending conditions of coins, allowing degradation and inheritance planning and all of this. We don't actually have those solutions available to us. So what do we learn from this? We learn that complicated that we need to be a little bit careful about dreaming up solutions and expecting that people will use them the way we expected them to use them. We need to be careful that they might use them in very different ways than we expected people to use them. And so, you know, the surface of any change is bigger than you can envision it to be. So we need to be very cautious. And I think this was what obsessed or like became a priority for Satoshi in his last days of being on the project. Most of what he did was he removed opcodes that he was fearful could be used to exploit Bitcoin and cause denial of service attacks or crashes or all sorts of things. So even Satoshi had to, as a mature engineer and brilliant as he was, he learned the lesson that if you're too permissive, you're not thinking adversarially enough and you need to be careful about it. And I think that that needs to be definitely a discipline that we have going forward. And to the extent that someone's proposing a change and other people are asking conservative questions about the attack surface, it will not do to be dismissive of those people. Right? Like it, and I think this is part of the challenge that we have. We have developers saying, you know, go look, I have a GitHub, go read it. It's like, well, you know, I'm actually asking about what the adversarial effects are on here. And let's have a conversation about how I might be able to attack the network if this thing, or how someone might be able to attack the network if this thing were approved. And they're like, no, look, we don't want to have that conversation. Here's the happy path that we have. And I don't see any problems with it. And if you're not prepared to have that particular conversation, then either you haven't thought, you're unwilling to think of something because you're not doing the right thinking job, or you've actually thought about it and you don't want to address it because there are concerns that we need to have. So we're going to move slowly one way or the other. And these attempts to force things through, especially as we've just seen over a very minor, like non-consensus setting, you can see that there's a tremendous backlash. Like we've got, by most accounts, at the time that we're recording this podcast, like 22% of the network has taken the effort to explicitly run a different client that they know is not going to have this feature. And meanwhile, in total, like 95, 96% of the network is not yet running the recent version that was released. I wouldn't expect a whole lot more to run it, but we're like living in the ambiguous timeframe where will we see a lot of adoption of this change, or will we actually see a lot of pause, hesitancy, and rejection of this change? And what does that say? And then there's all the social consequences of what this has done to the reputation of the developers who've pushed hard to make this change, despite the rational and irrational objections to it. It's a very complicated situation we have on our hands.
Very, yeah. I mean, you mentioned Satoshi, and there have been some high-profile figures sort of re-enter the conversation, like Nick Szabo.
Yeah.
And so, you know, to maybe speak to the magnitude of the disagreement.
Well, it's interesting. We've got Nick Szabo arguing with Adam Back, both who came late to this debate, right? Like Adam came quite late. I felt like a lot of the stuff he was playing a lot of catch up on. And when he first came into the debate and was talking about stewardship, I actually thought he was on the knots side. It was like the developers need to be stewards of this protocol and not do reckless things. I thought that was his message. And then somehow he reinterpreted and reframed his message as, technically speaking, like it doesn't really matter, although I would stick with a reasonable limit on opportune relay policy, I'm not really sure that it does anything anyways, and we need to, you know, not be hysterical. And I think, you know, from private conversations I have had with him, his concerns came down to the escalation of this thing to a debate about illegal imagery and the fact that he's had personal dealings in the past with Luke, and he's a little scared about Luke being unpredictable. But I think if he were more candid about those aspects and then didn't take a side rather than did take a side, but agreed that with, because there's the personal matters here, and then there's the details of execution. And if Adam is of the view that we shouldn't blow op return open to have no limit on it, then he's with many of the people who are in the Nods camp. The Nods camp is not entirely people who say, we think we should make Luke the benevolent dictator of Bitcoin. They're people who are saying we shouldn't have a collectivist dictatorship of Bitcoin. So it's like, and here now, doesn't this feel like elections in a two-party system that, you know, it's like that guy is bad. Like now we're blaming the people and not talking about the issues in particular. And some people are talking about the issues, but they're making exceptions to the issues because they're worried about the leader. And anyhow, and then Nick Szabo joined. I'm taking it a different direction. But like, we need to let this thing work its way through with, we need like a third party that's coming in and saying, here's what's actually sensible for Bitcoin. Here's a path that we want to follow that the user base of Bitcoin largely agrees with, this rough consensus term that's thrown around. I'm not crazy about it, but I don't have a better term. Right? Like there's rough consensus that Bitcoin is money. There's not rough consensus that Bitcoin is a database or that Bitcoin is a network, right? Like in the same sense that there's rough consensus that you and I are human beings, and there isn't rough consensus that we're a heart, that we're a brain. Like we're, yes, we have a heart. Yes, we have a brain, but we use it to be human beings. And that's the more accurate definition. And so I think when people say Bitcoin is a database or Bitcoin is a network, they're actually committing an epistemological mistake, a categorization mistake of like saying, I am a heart. Well, like Bitcoin has a database. I have a heart. I am not a heart. Bitcoin is not a database. Just because you have something doesn't make you the thing, you know? And so that's a logical fallacy, or it's an informal fallacy that is being used as a justification for treating Bitcoin differently from what it is, right? If you were only a heart, I wouldn't care about teaching you how to read. And I think that that's where the miscategorization ends up with people saying, well, you know, if Bitcoin is a database rather than Bitcoin is money, I'm going to treat it differently than I'm going to treat it otherwise, right? Under those two circumstances, you treat things quite differently. And that's where we've got this big debate. It's not the whole thing. I don't want to overstretch this, but we've certainly seen elements of this, you know, and I think that there are people who see Bitcoin as a technical playground even. And there's people who certainly don't see it as other people's technical playground. They view it as their store of value for their lifetime and that of their heirs. So it's like, it's a pretty big disagreement over what Bitcoin is.
Maybe for the benefit of listeners who aren't like as deep down this and some of the things that we've been talking about over the last 20 minutes, could you maybe just talk a little bit about like how core developers, like how many of them are there? How does that process work? And like you mentioned Luke, you know, so Luke's a one man.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak about it with, well, first of all, the history of it is debatable, disputable. So what I offer is a subject, if I'm going to answer your question, what I'm offering is a subjective point of view. Nobody has the whole view. Things that I'm about to say are bound to be mistaken. I haven't lived inside of core. I've not been a core developer or maintainer. So anything that I say, don't trust, verify is what I would say. And so I'm cautious to even respond to this question. But, you know, Bitcoin Core started as Bitcoin QT, Satoshi's client. There was one Bitcoin developer, Satoshi Nakamoto. And others joined, you know, not because they were paid to join by some company that was interested in, they joined out of interest. Gavin Andreessen was one, and Greg Maxwell is another one, Peter Wille. These are people who are prominent in the legacy of Bitcoin. And eventually Satoshi left and he left the keys with Gavin. He said, this project is in good hands, and disappeared. And those individuals ran it for a time until, interestingly enough, you know, Craig Wright showed up, and Craig Wright held some kind of bogus key signing ceremony in which Gavin was invited to. And Gavin said, I think this guy Craig is Satoshi. And the moment that he said that, or like within moments of him saying that, the other maintainers revoked his commit keys, revoked Gavin's commit keys, because it was clear that some stunt had been played. There was no public signing of a key. And so they were suspicious enough of him saying, I think Craig Wright is Satoshi, that they revoked his keys effective immediately on suspicious behavior. I think this is important because it gets us to the, and Craig didn't go away. Craig became a nuisance and an irritant. He raised money from, I can't remember the name of some billionaire who was in the poker online poker thing. And he created a lot of hardship. He launched lawsuits against core developers, right? He made their lives hard, which led to some of them disappearing or rescinding their roles. And we've had new developers come in, and those developers are developers who are getting funding from contributions. So it's a very different world now than it was before. Before, it was really interested and very sharp and bright, cryptographically experienced minds volunteering for the role and getting a big hassle for it, but participating early enough and earning the trust of the community. We've had a changing of the guard, and there's no lead maintainer anymore, as there was with Peter Willey, and they're younger, and they're, you know, I want to be careful in choosing my word, but I guess they have less experience, and they've spent different amounts of time in Bitcoin. They've entered it at a different point in its history. They're getting paid. It's a different thing. And I think for those of us who are outside looking in, many of us have concerns about, do they have the right experience? Is there the right process in place? Is there professionalism or maturity or wisdom? These are terms of judgment that I question whether, you know, I personally, Tomer Stroll, I question whether they have it. And it's not intended to say these are evil, bad people. It's just like, you know, when I was younger, there are lots of things that I didn't know that I do know now, but there was no way for me to know. It didn't make me a bad person, although it made me a bad judge of certain situations. And I had to become a good judge by making bad choices and living with the consequences. Right? And I think this is part of what we're all questioning now is, those of us who are questioning, what we're questioning is, do they have the right experience and maturity and incentives to make the decisions that are being made? You know, there's a lot of instances in this world, if we step away from Bitcoin Core, where young people think they know better than old people, and old people think young people are stupid, right? Are making reckless decisions. And history is rife with both sides being right at different points in time, right? Like the old man yelling at the clouds is not going to stop the world from changing, but the young person, what's the expression? Fools rush in where wise men fear to tread. You know, and those are young men, right? Who rush in where old men fear to tread and then get dealt a lesson from reality. So I think we've also got that particular tension going on right now. And we have this other dimension in here where it's like, not just speak different languages, and that some of us speak computer code and some of us don't. It leads us to thinking differently about the world, you know? So there's this technical view coming from Core and their supporter that the technology is what matters and the game theory plays it out. So they're living in this very mathematical realm. And then there's other people who are saying, well, there's a bunch of really unpredictable factors in this, and they're called human beings, and we got millions of them involved in this now, and they don't behave according to code, and they don't behave exclusively according to incentives. You know, they're very fuzzy beings. And so when you try to oversimplify the situation into the code executes and the game theory dictates how people will behave, you are dealt a very surprising situation. Like Core did not anticipate that 22% of the network would be running knots within a few months, and that certain arguments would be made, and that certain arguments would be sticky, and that all, like, it's not right. The code isn't right. You know, it's not running according to code. The people are buggy. The people need to do what we want them to do. So I don't know if that at all addressed your question around what is Core. And, you know, like, there's basically four or five people who are allowed to accept into the code base of the next version of Core what is going to run. And there's meant to be a process where that's all discussed and tested, and then the term is merged, you know, when you merge a pull request, that means it's into the code base, and the next time it's compiled, that will be in the, that code will be running in the code base. And so we've had one change that's very controversial between version 29 and version 30, maybe another one that's mildly controversial. So the big controversy is the policy of the Bitcoin nodes, not the consensus rules, but the policy of the Bitcoin nodes by default was that this text field op return would not be greater than 83 bytes. And if it was great, if your node received a transaction that had a op return that was greater than 83 bytes in length, your node would reject it and not transmit it to other nodes. It wouldn't share it with the network. And now the default is set to any size that's within the consensus rules, which is technically up to a megabyte, but for a single transaction is up to 100 kilobytes, will be accepted by your node, added to your own mempool, and relayed to other nodes. And if the miners are running the same version, they will accept these transactions and they will try to put them into blocks and they'll enter the blockchain. And so this debate is really all about that. This is a really complicated subject.
I know. I think you're doing a great job, and it's fascinating. It's amazing to me that that Bitcoin, you know, has ultimately four or five people that are responsible or empowered to have this kind of influence. And
one thing that's really nice about Bitcoin is there's no auto update feature. So these four or five people can make all the changes they want, but each individual, let me finish the thought and then take one step back. Only if node runners choose to run their new software do the changes get made. So this isn't like you're visiting a website like Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg has said, from now on, the login is going to go to the top left. And every time you load the page, the login is now at the top left, right? Or that, you know, messages from certain political views are to be filtered and now you can no longer see them. That is not how there's no central updating of Bitcoin. Bitcoin is fully decentralized. What is Bitcoin, the network aspect of it? It is only the Bitcoin nodes. There's no other element to it. It's this peer-to-peer system that sits on top of the internet and you run the application, which is the node client, which once you start, like if you download the node and you start it, the first thing it will do is it will look for block number one. It has the Genesis block embedded in it. And now it looks at the first thing it will do is look for other Bitcoin nodes on the internet. And it'll find some using its peer-to-peer protocol, and it'll connect to some. And it'll ask for the block header of the next block and all of these blocks. And then it'll ask for the content of all the blocks. And what it's doing is creating a perfect replica of the blockchain. And we're not going to get into how consensus works fully, but it creates a perfect replica. And every Bitcoin node ends up with the identical, bit-for-bit identical blockchain, which is the history of all of the on-chain transactions of Bitcoin and all the issuance of all the coins to whichever addresses miners earned them at, and then all the subsequent transactions of miners spending it to people and people spending it amongst themselves. That's what ends up happening. And so Bitcoin is nodes. Like the Bitcoin network is the nodes and the Bitcoin blockchain is the Bitcoins, you know, where they sit. It's unfortunate. In some sense, we have two words, one word for both the protocol and the currency and the units on it. We have to try to not get caught in equivocation when we're talking about one and someone might maybe thinking we're talking about the other, but Bitcoin is the nodes. And so the nodes all have to be in consensus about the state of the blockchain because they'll do different things. If they have different, and that would be called a chain split if we had different views, but the whole consensus rules mechanism, the proof of work is, as the arbiter of which block is the valid block, these all ensure that we are all on the same page. And so if someone like your Bitcoin is open source, you, Scott, are free to go in and make changes to the consensus rules. But if they loosen the consensus rules and somebody sends you a transaction that violates the other consensus rules but complies with your consensus rules, or if they put data in the block, you'll end up with a orphaned blockchain. Right? Your node will cease to keep adding the blocks that everybody else considers to be Bitcoin, and it'll wait for somebody else to mine on your new set of rules. And that's happened many times in the past. We had Bitcoin Cash fork at a certain point, Bitcoin SV forked off of that, and we've had Bitcoin Diamond and Bitcoin Gold. And there's more than I can even remember, because those are the only ones I remember. But there were dozens in the 2018 period that forked off by changing the consensus rules and therefore creating a different chain that had the same history up until the rules changed, but then had a new history. Because it's a graveyard, people are very hesitant to do consensus changes again, right? And we in the Bitcoin community were even very hesitant to make the Taproot change like it had been written. There wasn't really much objection to it, if any, but how we would make the change, how we would activate it, even though it was a backward compatible change that wasn't intended to, that wasn't expected to cause a chain split, there was anxiety about whether or not it would. And so there was hesitancy in how to activate it. It was all a matter of history, which we don't have time for today, and is a little bit off topic. But it always, because the people who are most involved and active in these discussions are all people who were around for past soft forks and hard forks. And, you know, there are people who like to say nobody wants to make these changes because they have PTSD. There's some legitimacy to that, right? Like there's a caution that when you make changes or go to war over changes, there's a price to pay. It's emotional, it's physical, it's psychological, and it's monetary. And like people who made the wrong choice on the hard forks lost a tremendous amount of money. Some people went all in on Bitcoin Cash, sold their Bitcoin, and now have, I don't know, $400 tokens instead of $100,000 tokens. Maybe they're $600. I don't know, but they're negligible value, right? It's like Bitcoin moves every minute by more than the worth of a Bitcoin Cash unit is. So where do we go from here, Scott? What's still on your mind?
Maybe one final question I love to ask you, sort of like to put a bow on this conversation, is do you have any thoughts on, you know, if you had more say on how decisions are made about the ongoing maintenance and development of Core, what would it look like for you?
Yeah, for me, the thing that this is me is speaking now and reflecting as an older man with a lot of experience having come from making mistakes when I was younger, not just having magically appeared with age, you know, like my brain, my memory is degraded. So I'm not using that as my advantage here. It's those with experience should be listened to, right? And in general, we should have a discussion. You know, one of my people know me as being a big fan of philosophy. And when I first started studying philosophy, I'm trying to remember the name of the book that I saw the citation in, but apparently in speaking about dialogue, right, the conversation between people, Plato is said to have said something very close to along the lines. It's obviously he said it in Greek, so this is not a word for word translation. But, you know, when men get together and discuss ideas without malicious intent, suddenly, you know, from that shines forth understanding. And I think this is all of us have different aspects and different insights into reality, different experiences. And if we come to a discussion and we're trying to win a debate, we're not listening to each other. We're not engaging in dialogue. We're engaging in debate, which is a different form of two-way communication. Dialogue is coming with the goal of understanding, not of winning. And this to me is what we've been struggling to have in Bitcoin over the course of this particular debate. I mean, it's been a debate, not a dialogue. And I think, you know, from my experience in this debate, it's been people with less experience who have turned it into a debate and refused to engage in dialogue. And I was no different when I was inexperienced. Right? Like, so I like to hold it against people and say, you know what, you're a bad person because you're young and inexperienced. I certainly wouldn't say that. And I know it sounds condescending to say you need to slow down and listen to those who have experience because there's a point that they're trying to make and they're trying to help you avoid a mistake. And, you know, I'll learn from my own mistakes. But when you're the pilot of the plane, to go back to a metaphor, and you're a young pilot and there's a lot of passengers on board and the plane costs tens of millions of dollars, they're not going to let you do erratic things. Right. Or they're going to grab the steering wheel, or they're going to be in panic if you're doing things that they perceive as erratic. I think that's the nature of the debate here. And people may say, the pilots may be saying, you know what, you guys all have PTSD. We can't trust your judgment. You're either, you don't know anything about flying planes, or you were in a plane during World War II. And of course you have PTSD because the Nazis were shooting bullets at you and trying to take you out of the skies. This is just a commercial airliner and we're just making room for cargo in addition to passengers. Don't panic. You know, trust us. We know what we're doing. We're the expert. So that's the nature of the debate. And we've lost part of the point that I was making that I failed to make when I was discussing the core processes. Like, the really seasoned, experienced, mature pilots aren't as involved as they used to be. So we've got a bunch of people who aren't pilots, but are experienced, and a bunch of people who are pilots and are somewhat less experienced, and we're fighting. And I wish we could get to a more rational discussion. And it's hard because egos get in the way. And I know I myself have been in some of these discussions. And if it feels like you're losing the debate, then your ego jumps in and says, you got to find some way to defend your position. You can't give in. And you need time away from it. Like, when you're caught in the heat of a debate, a different part of your brain activates, your amygdala activates, not your neocortex, which is where you can do thinking. It's just where you can do fight or flight is what activates. So you either leave the debate, which I've seen a lot of, or you engage in fight, in debate. So I think Bitcoin really requires that we act rationally, objectively, neutrally, and where neutrality is required, but not neutral about anything. It's like, Bitcoin isn't neutral in the sense of it doesn't have a purpose. It's neutral money in the sense that it doesn't play favorites as to who can spend it or not, but it's not a neutral idea that is anything. It's a specific thing. And part of the debate is what that specific thing is and who can change it to be something other than what it is right now. Not radically, but even ever so subtly, is highly debatable.
Yeah, that's this has been a lot to chew on, Tomer. I really appreciate your...
I hope it's helpful. I worry it may be more confusing than helpful, but at least it's true. And, for people who are listening to this, I'd say be patient. And for your own sake, if you're saying, well, this is too complicated to understand, I hope it actually encourages you to want to understand Bitcoin a little bit better. Right. And like, if you have a hard time reasoning about how Bitcoin works, then you have a hard time knowing who's making the true technically valid argument. I think we have individuals who claim to be on both sides who are doing their own sides a disservice by making mistakes and therefore giving the other side ammunition to say, see, they're mistaken about this. So, it's hard to get the technical truth. But there's also the societal aspect of it, which is, people have a sense for what a good approach and safe approach is, and something that is hard to change and harder to change back. And so I think that that's where a lot of people who are so many people who are less technical are finding themselves either saying, look, I trust the experts, I'm out of this thing, or saying, this is not a conversation that I can weigh in on because I don't understand enough, or saying, I feel like the experts, trust the experts is the thing that I rebel against. So I find myself here. But if you're in any of those camps, you're really, the middle one's the only right one of those, because it's like, I don't know, so I don't have an opinion, right? Like, I don't know, and I'm re-expressing somebody else's opinion is not right. Like, and you can base your knowledge off of different heuristics, and you can actually have a view that says, I really trust the judgment of people who have a lot of experience and a little bit of technical understanding, or enough technical understanding, or I really trust the judgment of this one person on this side. But you've got to get to some point of view if you're going to run a node. And if you've got a lot of skin in the game in Bitcoin, you really ought to be running a node. So it's like, there's no in the same way that there's no opting out of living in a society. You can't just say, I want to live, but not face, I don't want the Democrats or the Republicans. It's like, well, one of them's going to be in charge. You can not vote and say that you didn't vote, but like, you're going to be living in a country with the regime led by whoever wins the election. And Bitcoin is different. Like, it's not a winner take all thing here, right? We're like, if we've got There's a threshold at which point some of these transactions will get through. There's a threshold at which point many of them will get through. There's a potential for changing consensus rules eventually. There's a lot of dialogue to be had. So, and I think one of the things that you will realize that you've gotten into when you've gotten into Bitcoin is you've gotten into a system that is very hard to change. And so its promises are very reliable, but there are people who are trying to change the promises that it's trying to make. And you can do something about preventing them. But if they have a really great idea that improves what Bitcoin is doing by changing one or two of its promises or its restrictions, you may want to go along with it. So that's part of why Bitcoin is such good money. It can improve, but it's already really good to begin with. All right. I'm only making things more confusing. I hope people who listen to this find some sense of clarity, or at least zen with knowing that you don't know everything, right? And that's the biggest thing about Bitcoin. None of us have been here before. None of us have seen how Bitcoin matures. Bitcoin's the first and only one of its kind, and it's still very young. Accept the humility that nobody has all the answers, including yourself.
I could listen to you all day, Tomer. For anyone who is listening and they would like to find more of you, I know you're on Twitter. Where can we send listeners?
Yeah, I think if you like the thought processes of what I've said, go read my articles on Medium. There's a couple of ones that people really find interesting. So tomerstrohlite.medium.com. People really enjoy The Legendary Treasure of Satoshi Nakamoto. Hello, I'm Bitcoin is one that I get a lot of popularity on. Why People Wonder if Bitcoin is Alien Technology. People really enjoy that. If you're interested in reading more about the history of changing Bitcoin, I used to be the editor-in-chief at Swan. So if you go to swan.com/blog and search for my name, there's a trilogy of articles called Changing Bitcoin, part one, the past, part two, the present, part three, the future. It was written about a little over a year ago. So this debate was only just getting started. And it was maybe more focused on covenants rather than this op return thing, because that hadn't surfaced yet, but it's still a really relevant thing that talks about how hard it was to change Bitcoin in the past and what the consequences are, what is required to change Bitcoin in the present, and whether or not Bitcoin will ossify in the future. So if you want to delve into my written thoughts on that at the Swan blog, there's lots of articles I've written there. Yeah. And on Twitter, which is where I'm pretty active, at Tomer Strohlite.
Awesome. Thanks again, Tomer. And if you're listening and you made it all the way to the end of the episode, I want to thank you as well for tuning in. Hope to see you again next week.
Peace.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Block Reward. We're trying to do something different here, creating accessible conversations meant for people who aren't obsessed with Bitcoin. If you found this episode informative and engaging, hit that subscribe button to make sure you stay updated with future episodes. Your feedback matters. We'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to share your reviews and help us with our goal of creating Bitcoin content that is simple and easy to understand. Bitcoin has an important role to play in the future of finance. It will change the way we save, spend, and invest. Discover why Bitcoin offers a game-changing opportunity for forward-thinking employers by visiting blockrewards.ca. Block Rewards' mission is helping Canadian employers implement strategies for integrating Bitcoin into compensation and benefits. Supercharge your recruitment and retention strategies, and help your team members plan for the rising cost of living by rewarding their work with the hardest money ever invented. Big shout out to Podigy, our production team that makes all this possible, and BMX Escape for producing our music. Bitcoin is an expansive and dense topic many people walk away from early. To Bitcoin enthusiasts looking for that podcast they can share with friends, family, and colleagues, one they'll actually listen to, we hope that is us. The content of these conversations is meant to be provided for information purposes only. Nothing here is investment advice. Bitcoin is a big topic. Be sure to do your own research before making any personal financial decisions. Thanks for listening.